quietists and people of that kind. But even more where disciplines are adequate and where disciplines carry on the entire procedure. The Kabbalah as a structure has been of grave importance among Jewish people. Most peoples have feared it. They have wondered what it meant. They have felt that there was something strange, dangerous about it. But as we go into it, I would be quite certain that the entire structure of the Kabbalah, especially as it is given in the Sefer HaZohar, is a veiled statement of yogic discipline. That each of the sections and parts of it have to do with some part of the secret doctrine of human regeneration. Now, the process represented by the Merkabah must be considered as twofold. First, it is this personal, immediate discipline of religion, for it is absolutely essential to the religion of man that man experience religion, not that he merely listens while others talk about it. And at the core of every faith is an experience of faith, which must be cultivated, must be engendered, must be in some way made available to the believer. There is also, however, what might be termed the long-range program of religion. Religion is not completely fulfilled merely in the religious experience of the person. This is especially true among the Jewish people, who have a very strong sense of common salvation. Salvation not for the Jew, but for Israel. And therefore, that there must be a communal salvation in which all peoples working together must be lifted up together into the final state of blessedness. There is no question in the world also that while this subject is again a mystery, that the belief in metempsychosis or reincarnation did sustain the secret sects of Israel. Therefore, that they had, as in Asia, the concept of a long enduring process of self-improvement, the gradual overcoming of the world. They also recognized, as all mystics have, that the mystical experience is only a symbol, an intensified symbol of a process that must take place in society for the ultimate regeneration of all living things. That which comes to the mystic for a moment, in his trance or his ecstasy, represents the presence of faculties that must ultimately be so completely trained and disciplined and revealed that the whole world and all knowledge and all peoples will share in the same experience. Not only sharing in it for a moment, but sharing in it forever by the ultimate development of the faculties which produce it. Thus, in the Kabbalah, we have the immediate experience of truth, and we have the remote experience of the regeneration of all mankind. We have the concept that not only must the individual find this salvation for himself, but that it is part of a system which reveals within him and within all human beings the instrument necessary for this final perfection of man. So the Kabbalah actually does teach that within the nature and constitution of Adam, even though he be in a relapsed state, there is still the whole mystery of heaven. That the mystery of heaven is locked in him. That it was not taken from him, but closed within him. That as he fell into material condition, those parts of his nature which were divine were obscured, drugged, made heavy and laden, as in the Greek philosophy. But that these mysteries were not taken away, they were merely submerged, like some strange ancient land submerged beneath the depths of the ocean. Thus man coming into mortal existence was still the divine being he had always been, but his divinity was hidden as wings under a shell. And he was therefore born into this world, few of days and full of troubles. Yet within him always was the presence of a divine power, and more than this, the presence of a divine plan. And that the perfection of man is as inevitable as any other process in nature. For a time, this inevitable unfoldment, evolution, or release of man is carried on by nature. This process continues until there arises in man the mysterious complex which we call intellect. Gradually, as man passes through certain stages of evolution, he becomes a self-thinking creature. He becomes a being capable of reasoning power. He also becomes a being capable of self-understanding and self-analysis. As this change takes place within his nature, it does not change the laws under which he exists. He must still grow through space as he has always grown, step by step, in the fulfillment of every truth and principle which is part of his own being or of the universe in which he exists. It is, however, given to man, as the Mishnah also tells us, that at certain time that he takes hold upon his own destiny, that he is no longer a creature led in darkness. He is a self-leading creature. And at this time, a certain limited determinism, as Aquinas calls it, is conferred upon him. Man is now privileged to choose whether he shall consciously take upon himself the work of salvation, or whether he shall ignore this, continue in the furtherance of his own personal and private enterprises, and wait for nature to perfect the work. Most persons choose the latter course, and as a result of that, they are under a constant difficulty while nature is perfecting the work. Instead of cooperating, they are forced. They are driven by circumstances. They find their false interests and false projects collapse about them. They find that their selfishness brings only a measure of misery, sickness, and despair. Yet they are continuing it on their own way because they have the innate power to do so. There are others, however, that in time come to the conclusion that a conscious cooperation with the laws of growth and progress will simplify existence. Therefore, that there comes a time when man, becoming a self-directing creature, comes into the desperate need of insight. It is not enough merely to have the power to do as you please. The most important thing is to know what you should do, what you should please to be or to have or to attain. And as this situation arises usually in the life of the individual when he is not fully certain of these matters, he is thereby confronted with a mystery. He is confronted by an urge, a desire, an impulse, or an instinct to be better than he is without the skill to know how to achieve this end. He has not the experience which only life itself can bestow. He cannot know the ways of meditation because he has not experienced them, yet he desires to establish them in himself. He does not know the will of God for the creature, but he knows that he wishes to obey that will. Obedience without insight is a very difficult and treacherous thing. Consequently, a conscious cooperation with the universal plan implies the need for some way of increasing insight, some way of discovering the nature of that plan. Of course, under those conditions, the first thing that the religiously minded person might do is turn to his holy scriptures. He will turn to his sacred book. But there he will discover that he is again in difficulty. His own insight may not be sufficient to enable him to interpret the symbols, which were arbitrarily and curiously confused on purpose. The outer structure of the text will not suffice him. He is still, therefore, in a state of confusion. And in this state, of course, he then journeyed to the celebrated teachers and the rabbins and the learned and the wise, seeking from them the secret of this process within himself. Perhaps he found out the answer, perhaps he did not. But in most cases, if we go to Eastern philosophy for a parallel, he came ultimately to advice. He came ultimately to someone who had walked the way, and therefore who could instruct or inspire him in the manner in which he should proceed. If, however, this advice, this help, this presence was denied or not available, the Kabbalah tells us that it is not absolutely necessary. For if this person, as one Kabbalist points out, was cast away upon a desert island, without a book, without another human being, yet earnestly and completely in his own heart desired this knowledge. It could not be concealed from him. It would reach him in some way, usually through some internal experience of himself. So assuming for the moment that the outside teacher is not available, which is the common case in mysticism today, by the way, then the question arises, how shall it be achieved? The answer is that there is a certain witnessing which precedes these disciplines, by which there is a consecration of self, a simple statement of resolution, and the person following the practice of Apollonius of Tyana, the self-disciplined Pythagorean, simply says, I will practice certain principles, such as I know to be basically right, even though they are not adequate. I will prayerfully, quietly, lovingly, wisely carry forth this resolution in my life. The first step, therefore, as the Kabbalah points out, is the foundation in worthiness. This is within the reach of every person. This is merely the gradual living of a true life, a life dedicated to the best of the outer structure of our faith, a life lived in harmony with the commandments, a life lived in harmony with the Sermon on the Mount, a life lived as near as we can live it, in the true spirit of religion. This does not necessarily have anything to do with attending religious organizations. It is a personal conduct. It is a person living his principles because in his heart he believes them to be right, and refusing to compromise these principles because he realizes and is convinced in his own soul that these principles come from God. Therefore, of all things, they must not and cannot be compromised. Now, the ancients say that this is like going alone into the wilderness. The individual goes forth into a world that will not understand him, will probably to a measure persecute him as it has the prophets who went before him, a world in which many things which other people seem to find enjoyable through compromise, through failure to live principles, will be denied to him. Therefore, he is under a constant testing, a trial, a kind of initiation which he has imposed upon himself. If he is a fanatic, he fails. If he attempts more than he can achieve, he fails. If he hastens too rapidly over ground that he has not learned to walk, he will also fail. But if without ambition, without pride, without ulterior motive of any kind, without desire to excel, and according to the ancient mystical traditions, without even the desire to be known by God or to know of God, but simply because he inwardly believes this way of life is right, if impelled by no other consideration than this, he achieves the meditative existence and becomes one appointed, anointed, set apart by his own dedication. Then it is believed and taught that as it occurred to Ezekiel, at the moment in which his own readiness is found, at a time which only God knoweth, the mystery of the Merkava will be revealed. The heavens will open, and the secrets of the esoteric arts will be inwardly and intuitively known. Therefore, that it is not necessary for them to be communicated. It is only necessary that they be merited in a true, a complete, and adequate way. Now, this revelation comes not in a single night, or in a single hour or day, but consists of a gradual enrichment of the faculties and powers of the individual. He is simply growing more rapidly than his time. He is achieving in himself an increased tempo of evolution. He is growing in a rate which will cause him to be nearer to the goal of evolution than those around him. And in this process of personal, consecrated, intentional growth, he will also enjoy gradually the development of those faculties and powers which evolution has impelled all persons to expect and to know. These powers exist in man, Some persons will receive them 1,000 years from now, some nations 10,000 years from now. But to the individual who merits them by the anticipation of the qualities and practices related to them, they may be more immediately available. Thus, the powers of the seer are not a unique, unnatural group of powers. They are merely faculties that all men will possess in the fullness of time. But because the seer has dedicated himself, has anticipated time, has grown more rapidly than the common demand, he achieves ends which in his own day appear miraculous, but which will be sustained and justified in future ages. As he proceeds, therefore, the heavens open to him by degrees. All advancement is by degrees. And this advancement carries with it the next step of itself. And from these first experiences and experiments, the individual gradually unfolds within himself the latent powers of the method. Now, why does it happen, for example, that these yogic disciplines can unfold in him this way? Simply because yoga in itself is nothing but another expression of universal law. Therefore, yoga is to a certain phase of man's life what growth is to a plant. It is natural. It is inevitable. It may be acquired in a certain way for partial purposes by certain association, by initiation, by communion. But if these things are absent and the universe is honest, it must be that while it may be happy, convenient, and pleasant for the chela to sit at the feet of his guru and in this way gain enlightenment, it must also be that the disciple, if ready, must attain this enlightenment if there be no guru. It is only the power of the teacher to help and direct a situation. Parents do not cause their children to grow, but they may be present to help them in the process of growing. Parents do not cause their children to increase in stature or to mature from one age to another, but they are present to assist in these procedures. Growth is from within. Care and attention may be bestowed by love and friendship. In the same way, in the secret arts, the unfoldment of the doctrine is from within, and all that any teacher can do is to try to help the individual to unfold himself. If this individual is already unfolding according to the law, the various steps and disciplines of the sacred arts will be made known to him by the very processes of his own consciousness. Thus, as he needs, the need will be supplied, because this need is nothing more than a further unfolding of principles that are immutable within the disciple himself. So if in some nations these practices are called yogic, and in another group of peoples they have no name at all, this has nothing to do with their efficacy and fact. The Chinese Taoists practice them one way, the Japanese Buddhists another. The Zen tries to cut through them all with strange doctrines. They were parts of the wisdom of Persia and of Greece. They were known to Pythagoras and Plato. They have been always part of the wisdom of Islam and Arabia, and they have always been present in the mystical speculations of the Jewish people. Only some did not name them at all. Some only regarded them as a natural, slow, quiet walking towards infinity. Others made them quite complicated by term and symbol. Some attempted more assiduously than others to communicate them. Some simply experienced them, like the dervish mystic Jalaluddin. But named or nameless, growth is simply an unfoldment of natural processes. The unfoldment of mysticism from within the self. And all that man can do to achieve this growth is to prepare his own nature so that such growth is possible. This is done by achieving by intention such refinement of structure and attitude as would normally be bestowed by nature over a long period of time. If the disciple then achieves this readiness, as Hermes said, the master is here. And this master may come in the form of a person to help us, or may come in the quietude of our own inner life as a great insight, as a great experience, as a communion with the Most High, about which we may even have a very scattered and insecure comprehension. Now, as we go further into this problem again, let's drop back for a moment and study the parallels between the Sufis and the Jewish people on some of these problems. Perhaps some of you have seen one of the old Sufi dervish mystics in his own country. Perhaps you have noticed that some of them carry in their hands a peculiar kind of staff which has seven knots upon it. These knots are almost like the knots or breaks upon the branch of a bamboo. But the seven divisions are very carefully marked. There is no doubt in the world that these seven do represent the seven steps of yoga. There is no question in the world that the Sufi or dervish, sitting on his rug, with one hand or arm supported by a peculiar stick to sustain his arm, the other hand quietly in his lap, while his eyes half closed like some Buddhist image, he is meditating upon the mysteries of the infinite. These experienced teachers and mystics have always believed that by the power of their inner doctrine, they could journey to assemblies of their own kind. It is believed that these mystics project themselves at the time of the feast of Ramadan and join in a holy and sacred ceremony on the roof of the Kaaba at Mecca. These mystics traverse the whole world according to their own teachings, journeying here and there in the spirit alone. They possess the power, if they so will, to project an image of themselves that may be visible for a time. Then they vanish again, like the strange magicians of the Arabian Nights. The people of Islam today fully believe that these things are so, just as a great many Indian mystics, even in this rather materialistic and transitional period, are quite certain of the essential principles of their yogic teaching. Also, we know from more recent researchers that yoga actually does have a physiological effect upon man, that it is positively true and beyond doubt that the body is affected by these disciplines, that they can be used in correcting a great many physical problems of health, although this perhaps is their least importance. They can be used in controlling and directing the attitudes of the mind. They can be used in controlling and subduing the emotions. They can be used in the development and strengthening of extrasensory faculties and perceptions. These things have been the common knowledge of Asia for thousands of years. We have yet to disprove it, and what small, painful research we have made sustains rather than disproves this old belief and tradition. We are coming gradually here in the Western world today to a rather critical period in our own religious life. Perhaps the average person of today, more than at any other time in history, is completely isolated from what you might term a true mysticism. We have a certain amount of mystical or metaphysical organization. We have people who are sincere and devout seekers after mystical truth, but this strange world of mysticism that was known to our ancestors is strangely obscured for us today. For the most part, Western man is without resources in spiritual experience. His religion consists merely of conformities, acceptances, and, as far as he is able to indulge them, certain integrities of conduct. Now, these are important. Let's not minimize them. But these in themselves are no more than a moral code. And what man has today in his religion in the West is little more than a moral code. A moral code perhaps somewhat dignified by a circumstance of prayer. Even prayer, however, to Western man is a very difficult, distant, and uncertain ritual. Prayer is very highly formalized in the West. Or if it is not formalized, it is taken as a strangely literal thing, and most of its overtones and mysticisms are lost. We approach religion too much today as we would approach business or law or medicine or anything of that nature, as a kind of study, a subject perhaps more meritorious than the rest, a series of beliefs that certainly the young should enjoy and know. But some way, religion has lost its depth dimension. And I think we could say rather safely that since the foundation of the Western Hemisphere, there has been very little religion in the Western continent that has depth penetration. Some perhaps a little more than others. But the whole trend of religion in the West has been towards the recognition of a kind of religious formula, a formula of acceptances and rejections, a formula sanctified by sacraments themselves not generally understood, by which a person experiences the fact of being saved or not being saved, much as at an evangelical meeting. These dimensions are not adequate to a religious life. All religion must be grounded in the availability of the personal experience of God. All religion must truly be a means of approaching a higher state of consciousness. It must be an enrichment of our power to know, not merely our strength to believe. Religion must go somewhere. Religion must be something more than that which we take with us to the grave to help us to make a transition. Religion is not consolation in the last hours of life. Religion is a perpetual experience, an experience which belongs to all worlds and all spheres, and which we must carry with us out of this world as we brought it with us into this world. To get this higher concept of religion, there is only one possible way of approaching it, and that is to recognize that religion is a sacred science, that religion is a method anciently established by means of which man may attain maturity of consciousness. Unless we have this concept, our religions become very little in the terms of true solution. They become faiths we can change every weekend. They become beliefs in which we can share without being impelled to any particular change of attitude. They can be the kinds of religions which we take with us to war instead of using to maintain the peace. So in this entire mystery, the only possible solution to a religion is its depth dimension. Almost all known ancient religions, even those of primitive peoples, have this depth dimension. It is obvious from all of their sacred writings that the Jewish people had this depth dimension. But that, like all other peoples, including ourselves, all did not favor it, or know about it, or practice it. This is not so important. It isn't important to the dervish that his religion has this depth dimension, except in the sense that it is there when he is ready. He may not be ready. He does not demand that others practice it or that he practice it himself. But he knows it is there. And it is the knowing of the there-ness of it that gives the religion its tremendous authority. If man in the West knew as an experience of true belief that behind his religion there is an inevitable, immutable, and absolute discipline of personal reunion with deity, that this is the substance of his religion, and that the disciplines of his religion unfold his consciousness toward the availability of truth. And if he really believed this, that his religion was this ancient way, anciently known to all people, leading from ignorance to reality, that it had a dimension that science, art, literature, philosophy can never have. And that dimension is that religion leads to the personal experience of God. That this experience is an absolute scientific fact. That the only reason why it is not available to all is because all will not take the necessary effort or train themselves for it. This is not important. There is no demand that everyone does it. The only demand is that it can be done. And the secrets of how it can be done, and the circumstances associated with the doing, these become parts of the secret doctrine of the people, whether it be of Israel or of Asia. That there be such secret doctrine is essential. The fact that we are in such religious trouble today is that we do not believe this. We not only are not practicing what we actually claim, but we do not believe there is anything beyond a simple, more or less sincere effort to try to be good. We're not even sure what good is. We're not at all certain that we're making much of a try. And most people, in the privacy of their own lives, will admit they're not trying very hard. But there is also a reason why we do not try. Why should we work desperately after something that, as far as we know, has no substance in itself? So we try very hard. And if we try hard enough, someday we may go to heaven, if there is a heaven. This is not the stuff of a great spiritual integrity. But if we realize that our faith is a kind of gate, like that of the door of the mosque found upon the prayer wheel of the prayer flag of the Muslim, that our religion is the open door to infinity, that it is real, that it contains all the levels necessary to satisfy the needs of people, that for the child it is milk, and for the man it is meat, for those of various perceptions it is what they perceive, to the artist it is art, to the musician it is music. But beyond and above all these things, religion is the royal road that leads inevitably to realization. That this realization is the purpose of life, the royal end towards which all things achieve, and that the secret methods by means of which this achievement is possible are truly the magical instruments, the great machines, the chariot of righteousness. If we can sense this, make it a vital part of life, we will cease to speculate about religion. And we will get over this interminable problem as what is tolerance and what is intolerance. There is no question as to who is right. There is no question as to who is wrong. Theories add or detract but little. The problem is that there are laws by which man grows in grace. He keeps these laws and grows, or he breaks these laws and he does not grow. All theories have no effect, no meaning, no essential significance whatsoever. Now, because the principles of yoga are merely a phase of universal procedure captured in a diagram or a symbol, so actually what we term yoga in relating to India, and that is only a national name for it, we do not become Hindus by practicing yoga. We do not become members of any religion by obeying the law of existence. But if we obey, we should be members in good standing of any faith that is honorable. There's no question as to this fact. And in most instances, we will find it to be true. When traveling among peoples of other faiths, I have found it to be true. But the principle of self-development by discipline is archetypal. It is part of the subconsciousness of humanity. Just as surely as religion is an instinct in man and not an institution created by man, so in truth, the laws governing the perfection of man are known in the interior consciousness of himself. They are subconscious to his own nature. He knows that at certain periods in his religious life, he will be as a child, growing and receiving instruction. He knows also that at certain periods of his religious life, he will become as a man and will take upon himself the control of his own spiritual destiny under God. That he may have various ways of developing this destiny. That this destiny does not mean that he has to go out and wander in the wilderness, nor neglect the problems of life, nor shirk responsibilities, nor run away from the common duties of the day. The true practice of religion consists of this acceptance of a methodology and the recognition that the detail of this method will unfold as an experience of consciousness as necessary. Therefore, that it is not to be falsely cultivated, and when it comes naturally and properly, it brings no doubts, no questions, no uncertainties, and no dangers. When it is falsely cultivated, or prematurely attempted, or forced by intellectual means alone, it can be of the greatest menace and danger and problem to the human being. So what we know as this process of human regeneration is nothing more or less than human evolution. It is evolution hastened by effort, by will, discipline, and dedication. And this is, again, an interesting parallel to the wheels of Ezekiel, because according to the old writers, these wheels represented the great wheels or structures of cosmic law. Therefore, the chariot that carries the soul to conscious identity with God is the chariot of universal law itself. It is not something different. It is not a magical thing. It is law, perfecting all things by its own nature. Everything that happens is lawful. Every effect follows its cause. Every principle works out according to its own principles. Therefore, the achievement of the Merkava, or the achievement of righteousness, is itself the outworking of a cause. This cause in man is dedication. This is consecration. This is realization. This is incentive, the determination to attempt the mystery of the advancement of the human psychic entity. Now, today we have a great deal of discussion of psychic entity. We know that within each of us is an untutored soul. We know it is untutored by the way it conducts itself. We also know that it is untutored and uncivilized by the difficulty we have getting along with it. We also realize that it is irrational because it does not lead us to rationality, but rather leads us to the counselor's couch instead, which is not really the noble end of the soul. We also suspect that this soul has laws, principles, and rules. That this soul, like the great mother of mysteries herself, is a creature loving truth, seeking reality, fulfilling its own divine destiny. For all things of themselves follow God. Why then do we have this trouble? Because the soul is itself neglected, because its energies have been perverted, because we have used its faculties for purposes inferior to its own nature, and like the blinded Samson, we have bound it to the millstone of our Philistine interests. There is therefore only this point to bear in mind. The soul itself, which is the proper subject of yoga, is an entity waiting to be civilized, waiting to be moved along the path of evolution to its own maturity. It is not going to be made well by dopes and drugs. It is not going to be made to mature merely by being occasionally ventilated. There are times in which a strong laxative will help, but you cannot purge the soul forever. Therefore, what we need is the realization of the laws governing soul and the courage to keep these laws. And these laws are part of yoga. For it is indeed the very end of yoga that the being in the body shall attain its maturity. That it is this being within the body which in turn must finally approach the eternal. So there are disciplines all the way along. We have to teach children to walk. We have to teach men to think. We have to teach souls to grow. All these things are part of the natural duties of realization and association. It was the opinion of the old rabbis, therefore, that the great heritage of Israel was the law, that this law was the revelation of God for his creatures. This was the very foundation of all things. It was a little different in Israel in old days than it is now in other countries. Perhaps the Muslim world comes the nearest today, perhaps the Hindu, but there are still changes even in these approaches to belief. But in Israel, the law was the whole of the law. The law was the basis of every factor in life. Life moved from a religious conviction. Medicine was practiced according to religion. Legal matters were settled according to religion. The problem of crops and the division of the land, of profits on goods, of barter and exchange, all of these things were religion. There was nothing apart from religion. Religion had to do with the water supply, with the carrying of food across the desert, with the caravans and the camel routes. It had to do with the date palms and the rocky land where the black tents had to be spread at night. Everything was religion. Consequently, there was no, we might say, profanity in the concept of this people. They did not always keep their faith, and for their weaknesses, God was forever chastising them through the entire Old Testament. But at the same time, there was still promise in the prophets that God would forgive. It is the same in a sense today. Everything that we have around us, everything that we do, is essentially religious. Yet we have come to divide religion from practice, assuming that when we talk about God, it is religion. When we talk about practical matters, it is commerce or economics. And there is very little in common between the codes applied to these different fields of specialization. Actually, therefore, in Israel, when you talked about happiness, you talked about religion. When you talked about health, growth, and veneration for the aged, when you talked about the hope of the people, the coming of the Messiah, the golden age we looked for, when peace would come to Israel, and the wounds of the tribes should be mended, and when the temple of Herod again would stand up on the sacred hill. These things were religion, and they made up the whole life of the people. Therefore, it is not unusual or impossible or unreasonable that religion, meaning so much, would have to begin to some mean even more. So where all men were by nature religious, then the outstanding person had to be outstandingly religious. And in this sense of the word, you come into his esoteric teaching. You come into the disciplines which he practiced, the ancient rules and rites which he followed, the magical arts with which he was accomplished. All these things went deeper and deeper. But in the very deepest part of all, in the veneration of the people, was the man who could talk to God, the man who could speak face to face with the angels, and who could reveal the will of God as Jonah revealed the will of God to his people. These prophets of the Lord, who in the silence of their mysticism received the impressions which were to rule Israel, these were the most valued and hallowed of all men. And before them even the kings of Israel must bow and acknowledge the greatness of their ways. So in this way, the esoteric doctrine in Israel came to bear fruit, although the tree upon which the fruit grew was never very clearly defined. The mystic, the clairvoyant, the sage, the saint, the individual who transcended death, the person who rose from the grave, who vanished and appeared in other places, all of these things are referred to in the scriptures. We know not who the strange master of mysteries was, whom we know as Melchizedek, king of Salem. We do not know who the mysterious angel was that wrestled with Jacob. But we know that in these early things, mysticism and physical things blended together out of a strange mingling of the magical and the commonplace. Wherever such reports exist, wherever such fables are perpetuated, we know that the old mysticism was in operation. the story of this mysticism as the instrument for the carrying of human consciousness from this world to eternity, and perhaps back again, to bring warning to the people. This machinery, this magic, this power, this Merkava of ecstasy, was almost certainly and beyond question what we call yoga, the secret doctrine of Asia, restored or reappearing to us again in the sod of Israel, in the assembly, in the secret teachings, among the mystics, such as the Jhananites, and the Essenes, and the Therapeutae, and the Nazarenes, and the Gebas, and all these strange sects who practice strange mysteries. And these strange mysteries, which later did descend into the early years of the church, had to do with this secret art of salvation, which has been present in the religions of all people. Time's up, I think.